We fight with an enemy whose secret strength we cannot discover, whom we cannot follow into its retirements. Hence, oftentimes, when we are ready to think sin quite ruined, after a while we find it was but out of sight. It has culverts and retreats in an unsearchable heart, whither we cannot pursue it. The soul may persuade itself all is well, when sin may be safe in the hidden darkness of the mind, which it is impossible that he should look into, for whatever makes manifest is light. It may suppose the will of sinning is utterly taken away, when yet there is an unsearchable reserve for a more suitable object, a more vigorous temptation, than at present it is tried with. Hath a man had a contest with any lust, and a blessed victory over it by the Holy Ghost as to that present trial? When he thinks it is utterly expelled, he ere long finds that it was but retired out of sight. It can lie so close in the mind's darkness, in the will's indisposition, in the disorder and carnality of the affections, that no eye can discover it. The best of our wisdom is but to watch its first appearances, to catch its first under earth heavings and workings, and to set ourselves in opposition to them, for to follow it into the secret corners of the heart, that we cannot do. It is true there is yet a relief in this case, namely, that he to whom the work of destroying the law of sin and body of death in us is principally committed, namely, the Holy Ghost, comes with his acts to the very root. Neither is there anything in an unsearchable heart that is not naked and open unto him, Hebrews 4:13, but we in a way of duty may hence see what an enemy we have to deal with. Number 2. As it is unsearchable, so it is deceitful, as in the place above mentioned. It is deceitful above all things, incomparably so. There is great deceit in the dealings of men in the world, great deceit in their counsels and contrivances in reference to their affairs, private and public, great deceit in their words and actings. The world is full of deceit and fraud. But all of this is nothing to the deceit that is in man's heart towards himself, for that is the meaning of the expression in this place and not towards others. Now incomparable deceitfulness added to unsearchableness gives a great addition and increase of strength to the law of sin, upon the account of its seat and subject. I speak not yet of the deceitfulness of sin itself, but the deceitfulness of the heart where it is seated. Proverbs 26:25. There are 7 abominations in the heart, that is, not only many, but an absolute complete number as 7 denotes. And they are such abominations as consist in deceitfulness. So the caution foregoing insinuates, trust him not, for it is only deceit that should make us not to trust in that degree and measure which the object is capable of. Now this deceitfulness of the heart, whereby it is exceedingly advantaged in its harboring of sin, lies chiefly in these 2 things. Number 1, that it abounds in contradictions, so that it is not to be found and dealt with according to any constant rule and way of procedure. There are some men that have much of this, from their natural constitution and from other causes, in their conversation. They seem to be made up of contradictions, sometimes to be very wise in their affairs, sometimes very foolish, very open and very reserved, very facile and very obstinate, very easy to be entreated, and very revengeful, all in a remarkable height. This is generally accounted a bad character, and is seldom found but when it proceeds from some notable predominant lust. But in general, in respect of moral good or evil, duty or sin, it is so with the heart of every man, flaming hot and key cold, weak and yet stubborn, obstinate and facile. The frame of the heart is ready to contradict itself every moment. Now you would think, had it all for such a frame, such a way, anon it is quite otherwise, so that none can know what to expect from it. The rise of this is the disorder that is brought upon all its faculties by sin. God created them all in a perfect harmony and union. The mind and reason were in perfect subjection and subordination to God and His will. The will answered in its choice of good, the discovery made of it by the mind, the affections constantly and evenly followed the understanding and will. The mind's subjection to God was the spring of the orderly and harmonious motion of the soul and all the wills in it. That being disturbed by sin, the rest of the faculties move cross and contrary one to another. The will chooseth not the good which the mind discovers. The affections delight not in that which the will chooseth, but all jar and interfere, cross and rebel against each other. This we have got by our falling from God. Hence sometimes the will leads, the judgment follows. Yea, commonly the affections that should attend upon all get the sovereignty and draw the whole soul captive after them. And hence it is, as I said, that the heart is made up of so many contradictions in its actings. Sometimes the mind retains its sovereignty and the affections are in subjection, and the will ready for its duty. This puts a good face upon things. Immediately the rebellion of the affections or the obstinacy of the will takes place and prevails, and the whole scene is changed. This, I say, makes the heart deceitful above all things. It agrees not at all in itself, is not constant to itself, hath no order that is constant unto, is under no certain conduct that is stable, but, if I may so say, hath a rotation in itself, or oft times the feet lead and guide the whole. Number 2. Its deceit lies in its full promisings upon the first appearance of things, and this also proceeds from the same principle with the former. Sometimes the affections are touched and wrought upon, the whole heart appears in a fair frame, all promiseth to be well. Within a while the whole frame is changed. The mind was not at all affected or turned, the affections a little acted their parts and are gone off, and all the fair promises of the heart are departed with them. Now add this deceitfulness to the unsearchableness before mentioned, and we shall find that at least the difficulty of dealing effectually with sin in its seat and throne will be exceedingly increased. A deceiving and a deceived heart, who can deal with it? Especially considering that the heart employs all its deceits unto the service of sin, contributes them all to its furtherance. All the disorder that is in the heart, all its false promises and fair appearances, promote the interest and advantages of sin. Hence God cautions the people to look to it, lest their own heart should entice and deceive them. Who can mention the treacheries and deceits that lie in the heart of man? It is not for nothing that the Holy Ghost so expresseth it. It is deceitful above all things, uncertain in what it doth, and false in what it promiseth. And hence, moreover, it is, amongst other causes, that in the pursuit of our war against sin, we have not only the old word to go over and over, but new works still while we live in this world, still new stratagems and wiles to deal withal, as the manner will be where unsearchableness and deceitfulness are to be contended with. There are many other properties of the seed and subject of the law of sin, which might be insisted on to the same end and purpose, but that would too far divert us from one particular design, and therefore I shall pass these over with some few considerations first. Never let us reckon that our work in contending against sin, in crucifying, mortifying, and subduing of it, is at an end. The place of its habitation is unsearchable, and when we may think that we have thoroughly won the field, there is still some reserve remaining that we see not, that we knew not of. Many conquerors have been ruined by their carelessness after a victory, and many have been spiritually wounded after great successes against this enemy. David was so. His great surprisal into sin was after a long profession, manifold experiences of God, and watchful keeping himself from his iniquity. And hence in part hath it come to pass that the profession of many hath declined in their old age a riper time, which must more distinctly be spoken to afterward. They have given over the work of mortifying a sin before their work was at an end. There is no way for us to pursue sin in its unsearchable habitation but by being endless in our pursuit. And that command of the apostle which we have, Colossians 3:5, on this account is as necessary for them to observe, who are towards the end of their race, as those that are but at the beginning of it. Mortify, therefore, your members which are upon the earth. Be always doing it whilst you live in this world. It is true, great ground is obtained when the work is vigorously and constantly carried on. Sin is much weakened so that the soul presseth forward towards perfection, but yet the work must be endless. I mean, whilst we are in this world. If we give over, we shall quickly see this enemy exerting itself with new strength and vigor. It may be under some great affliction, it may be in some imminent enjoyments of God, in the sense of the sweetness of blessed communion with Christ, we have been ready to say that there was an end of sin, that it was dead and gone forever. But have we not found the contrary by experience? Hath it not manifested that it was only retired into some unsearchable recesses of the heart, as to its in being and nature, though it may be greatly weakened in its power? Let us then reckon on it, that there is no way to have our work done but by always doing of it. And he who dies fighting in this warfare dies assuredly a conqueror. Secondly, hath it its residence in that which is various, inconstant, deceitful above all things? This calls for perpetual watchfulness against it. An open enemy that deals by violence only always gives some respite. You know where to have him and what he is doing, so if that sometimes you may sleep quietly without fear. But against adversaries that deal by deceit and treachery, which are long swords and reach at the greatest distance, nothing will give security but perpetual watchfulness. It is impossible we should in this case be too jealous, doubtful, suspicious, or watchful. The heart hath a thousand wiles and deceits, and if we are in the least off from our watch, we may be sure to be surprised. Hence are those reiterated commands and cautions given for watching, for being circumspect, diligent, careful, and the like. There is no living for them who have to deal with an enemy deceitful above all things, unless they persist in such a frame. All cautions that are given in this case are necessary, especially that, remember not to believe. Doth the heart promise fair? Rest not on it, but say to the Lord Christ, Lord, do thou undertake for me. Doth the sun shine fair in the morning? Reckon not, therefore, on a fair day, the clouds may arise and fall. Though the morning give a fair appearance of serenity and peace, turbulent affections may arise and cloud the soul with sin and darkness. Thirdly, then, commit the whole matter with all care and diligence unto him who can search the heart to the uttermost, and knows how to prevent all his treacheries and deceits. In the things before mentioned lies our duty, but here lies our safety. There is no treacherous corner in our hearts, but he can search it to the uttermost. There is no deceit in them, but he can disappoint it. This course David takes, Psalm 139, after he had set forth the omnipresence of God and his omniscience, verses 1 to 10, he makes improvement of it, verse 23. Search me, O God, and try me, as if he had said, it is but a little that I know of my deceitful heart. Only I would be sincere. I would not have reserves for sin retained therein. Wherefore, do thou who art present with my heart, who knowest my thoughts long before, undertake this work, perform it thoroughly, for thou alone art able so to do. There are yet other arguments for the evidencing of the power and strength of indwelling sin, from whence it is termed a law which we must pass through according to the order wherein before we laid them down. Chapter 4. Indwelling sin, enmity against God, thence its power. Secondly, we have seen the seat and subject of this law of sin. In the next place, we might take a view of its nature in general, which also will manifest its power and efficacy. But this I shall not enlarge upon, it being not my business to declare the nature of indwelling sin. It hath also been done by others. I shall, therefore, only in reference unto our special design in hand, consider one property of it that belongs unto its nature, and this always wherever it is. And this is that which is expressed by the Apostle Romans 8:7, the carnal mind is enmity against God. That which is here called the wisdom of the flesh is the same with the law of sin which we insist on. And what says he hereof? why it is enmity against God. It is not only an enemy, for so possibly some reconciliation of it unto God might be made, but it is enmity itself, and so not capable of accepting any terms of peace. Enemies may be reconciled, but enmity cannot. Yea, the only way to reconcile enemies is to destroy the enmity. So the apostle in another case tells us, Romans 5:10, we who are enemies are reconciled to God. That is, a work compassed and brought about by the blood of Christ. The reconciling of the greatest enemies. But when he comes to speak of enmity, there is no way for it, but it must be abolished and destroyed, Ephesians 2:15. Having abolished in his flesh the enmity, there is no way to deal with any enmity whatever but by its abolition or destruction. And this also lies in it, as it is enmity, that every part and parcel of it, if we may so speak, the least degree of it that can possibly remain in anyone, whilst and where there is anything of its nature, is enmity still. It may not be so effectual and powerful in operation as where it hath more life and vigor, but it is enmity still. As every drop of poison is poison and will infect, and every spark of fire is fire and will burn, so everything of the law of sin, the last and the least of it, it is enmity, it will poison, it will burn. That which is anything in the abstract is still so whilst it hath any being at all. Our apostle, who may well be supposed to have made as great a progress in the subduing of it as anyone on the earth, yet after all cries out for deliverance, is from an irreconcilable enemy, Romans 7:24. The meanest acting, the meanest and most imperceptible working of it, is the acting and working of enmity. Mortification abates of its force, but doth not change its nature. Grace changeth the nature of man, but nothing can change the nature of sin. Whatever effect be wrought upon it, there is no effect wrought in it, but that it is enmity still, sin still. This, then, by it, is our state and condition. God is love, 1 John 4:8. He is so in himself, eternally excellent and desirable above all. He is so to us. He is so in the blood of his Son, and in all the inexpressible fruits of it, by which we are what we are, and wherein all our future hopes and expectations are wrapped up. Against this God we carry about us an enmity all our days, an enmity that hath from its nature that it is incapable of cure or reconciliation. Destroyed it may be, it shall be, but cured it cannot be. If a man hath an enemy to deal with all that is too mighty for him, as David had with Saul, he may take the course that he did, consider what it is that provoked his enemy against him, and so address himself to remove the cause and make up his peace, 1 Samuel 26:19. If the Lord has stirred thee up against me, let him accept an offering, but if they be the children of men, cursed be they before the Lord. Come it from God or man, there is yet hope of peace. But when a man hath enmity itself to deal with, nothing is to be expected but continual fighting, to the destruction of the one party. If it be not overcome and destroyed, it will overcome and destroy the soul. And herein lies no small part of its power which we are inquiring after. It can admit of no terms of peace, of no composition. There may be a composition where there is no reconciliation. There may be a truce where there is no peace. But with this enemy we can obtain neither the one nor the other. It is never quiet, conquering nor conquered. Which was the only kind of enemy that the famous warrior complained of old. It is in vain for a man to have any expectation of rest from his lust, but by its death. Of absolute freedom, but by his own. Some in the tumultuating of their corruption seek for quietness by laboring to satisfy them, making provision for the flesh to fulfill the lust thereof, as the apostle speaks, Romans 8:14. This is to a slake fire by wood and oil. It's all the fuel in the world, all the fabric of creation that is combustible, being cast into the fire will not at all satisfy it, but increase it. So it is with satisfaction given to sin by sinning. It doth but inflame and increase. If a man will part with some of his goods unto an enemy, it may satisfy him. But enmity will have all, and is not one whit the more satisfied than if he had received nothing at all, like the lean cattle that were nevertheless hungry for having devoured the fat. You cannot bargain with the fire to take but so much of your houses. You have no way but to quench it. It is in this case, as it is in the contest between a wise man and a fool, Proverbs 29:9, whether he read or laugh, there is no rest. Whatever frame or temper he be in, his importunate folly makes him troublesome. It is so with this indwelling sin, whether it violently tumultuate, as it will do on provocations and temptations, it will be outrageous in the soul, or whether it seem to be pleased and contented, to be satisfied, all is one, there is no peace, no rest to be had with it or by it. Had it then been of any other nature, some other way might have been fixed on, but seeing it consists in enmity, all the relief the soul hath must lie in its ruin. Secondly, it is not only said to be enmity, but is said to be enmity against God. It hath chosen a great enemy indeed. It is in sundry places proposed as our enemy, 1 Peter 2:11. Abstain from fleshly lusts, which war against the soul. They are enemies to the soul, that is, to ourselves. Sometimes as an enemy to the spirit that is in us, the flesh lusteth or fighteth against the spirit. Galatians 5:17. It fights against the spirit or the spiritual principle that is in us to conquer it. It fights against our souls to destroy them. It hath special ends and designs against our souls, and against the principle of grace that is in us. But its proper formal object is God. It is enmity against God. It is its work to oppose grace. It is consequent of its work to oppose our souls, which follows upon what it doth more than what it intends. But its nature and formal design is to oppose God. God as the lawgiver. God is holy, God as the author of the gospel, a way of salvation by grace and not by works. This is the direct object of the law of sin. Why doth it oppose duty, so that the good we do not, either as to matter or manner? Why doth it render the soul carnal, indisposed, unbelieving, unspiritual, and wandering? It is because of its enmity to God, whom the soul aims to have communion with all in duty. It hath, as it were, the command from Satan, which the Assyrians had from their king, fight neither with small nor great, save only with the king of Israel. 1 Kings 22:31. It is neither great nor small, but God himself, the King of Israel, that sin sets itself against. There lies the secret formal reason of all its opposition to good, even because it relates unto God. May a road, a trade, a way of duties be set up, where communion with God is not aimed at, but only the duty itself, as is of the manner of men in most of their superstitious worship. The opposition that will lie against it from the law of sin will be very weak, easy, and gentle. Or as the Assyrians, because of a show of a king, assaulted Jehoshaphat, but when they found that it was not Ahab, they turned back from pursuing of him, so because there is a show and appearance of the worship of God, sin may make head against it at first, but when the duty cries out in the heart that indeed God is not there, sin turns away to seek out its proper enemy, even God himself, elsewhere. And hence do many poor creatures spend their days in dismal, tiring superstitions without any great reluctancy from within, when others cannot be suffered freely to watch with Christ in a spiritual manner 1 hour. And it is no wonder that men fight with carnal weapons for their superstitious worship without, when they have no fighting against it within, for God is not in it, and the law of sin makes not opposition to any duty, but to God in every duty. This is our state and condition. All the opposition that ariseth in us unto anything that is spiritually good, whether it be from darkness in the mind, or aversion in the will, or sloth in the affections, all the secret arguings and reasonings that are in the soul to pursuit of them, the direct object of them is God Himself. The enmity lies against Him, which consideration surely should influence us to a perpetual, constant watchfulness over ourselves. It is thus also in respect of all propensity unto sin as well as aversion from God. It is God Himself that is aimed at. It is true, the pleasures, the wages of sin, do greatly influence the sensual, carnal affections of men. But it is the holiness and authority of God that sin itself rises up against. It hates the yoke of the Lord. Thou hast been weary of me, saith God to sinners, and that during their performance of abundance of duties. Every act of sin is a fruit of being weary of God. Thus Job tells us what lies at the bottom in the heart of sinners. They say to God, "Depart from us." It is enmity against Him and aversion from Him. Here lies the formal nature of every sin. It is an opposition to God, a casting off His yoke, a breaking off the dependence which the creature ought to have on the Creator. And the Apostle Romans 8:7 gives the reason why this. He affirms the carnal mind to be enmity against God, namely, because it is not subject to the will of God, nor indeed can be. It never is, nor will, nor can be subject to God, its whole nature consisting in an opposition to Him. The soul wherein it is may be subject to the law of God, but this law of sin sets up in a contrariety unto it, and will not be in subjection. To manifest a little further the power of this law of sin from this property of its nature, that it is enmity against God, one or two inseparable adjuncts of it may be considered which will further evince it. Number one, it is universal. Some contentions are bounded unto some particular concernments, this about one thing, that about another. It is not so here. The enmity is absolute and universal, as are all enmities that are grounded in the nature of the things themselves. Such enmity is against the whole kind of that which is its object. Such as this enmity, for it is universal to all of God, and it is universal in all of the soul. Number one, it is universal to all of God. If there were anything of God, His nature, properties, His mind or will, His law or gospel, any duty of obedience to Him, of communion with Him, that sin had not an enmity against, the soul might have a constant shelter and retreat within itself by applying itself to that of God, to that of duty towards Him, to that of communion with Him, that sin would make no opposition against. But the enmity lies against God, and all of God, and everything wherein or whereby we have to do with Him. It is not subject to the law, nor any part or parcel, word or tittle of the law. Whatever is opposite to anything as such is opposite unto all of it. Sin is enmity to God as God, and therefore to all of God. Not His goodness, not His holiness, not His mercy, not His grace, not His promises. There is not anything of Him which it doth not make head against, nor any duty, private, public, in the heart, in external works, which it opposeth not. And the nearer, if I may so say, anything is to God, the greater is its enmity unto it. The more a spirituality and holiness is in anything, the greater is its enmity. That which hath most of God hath most of its opposition. Concerning them in whom this law is most predominant, God says, "Ye set it not on my counsel, and would none of my reproof." Proverbs 1:25. Not this or that part of God's counsel, His mind or will is opposed, but all His counsel, whatever He calleth for or guideth unto, and every particular of it, all is set at naught, and nothing of His reproof attended unto. a man would think it not very strange that sin should maintain an enmity against God and his law, which comes to judge it, to condemn it, but it raiseth a greater enmity against him and his gospel, wherein he tenders mercy and pardon as a deliverance from it, and that merely because more of the glorious properties of God's nature, more of his excellencies and condescension is manifested therein than in the other. 2. It is universal in all of the soul. Would this law of sin have contented itself to have subdued any one faculty of the soul? Would it have left any one at liberty, any one affection free from its yoke and bondage? It might possibly have been with more ease opposed or subdued. But when Christ comes with a spiritual power upon the soul to conquer it to himself, he hath no quiet landing place. He can set foot on no ground but what he must fight for and conquer. Not the mind, not an affection, not the will, but all is secured against him. And when grace hath made its entrance, yet sin will dwell in all its coasts. Were anything in the soul at perfect freedom and liberty, there a stand might be made to drive it from all the rest of its holds, but it is universal, and wars in the whole soul. The mind hath its own darkness and vanity to wrestle with. The will its own stubbornness, obstinacy, and perverseness, every affection its own frowardness and aversion from God, and its sensuality to deal withal, so that one cannot yield relief unto another as they ought. They have, as it were, their hands full at home. Hence it is that our knowledge is imperfect, our obedience weak, love not unmixed, fear not pure, delight not free and noble. But I must not insist on these particulars, or I could abundantly show how diffused this principle of enmity against God is through the whole soul. Number 2. Hereunto might be added its constancy. It is constant unto itself. It wavers not. It hath no thoughts of yielding or giving over, notwithstanding the powerful opposition that is made unto it both by the law and gospel, as afterwards shall be showed. This, then, is a third evidence of the power of sin taken from its nature and properties, wherein I affix but on one instance for its illustration, namely, that it is enmity against God, and that universal and constant. Should we enter upon a full description of it, it would require more space and time than we have allotted to this whole subject. What hath been delivered might give us a little sense of it, if it be the will of God, and stir us up unto watchfulness. What can be of a more sad consideration than that we should carry about us constantly that which is enmity against God, and that not in this or that particular, but in all that he is, and in all wherein he hath revealed himself? I cannot say it is well with them who find it not. It is well with them indeed in whom it is weakened, and the power of it abated. But yet for them who say it is not in them, they do but deceive themselves, and there is no truth in them. Chapter 5. Nature of sin further discovered, as it is enmity against God. Its aversion from all good opened. Means to prevent the effects of it prescribed. Thirdly, we have considered somewhat of the nature of indwelling sin, not absolutely, but in reference unto the discovery of its power. But this more clearly evidenceth itself in its actings and operations. Power is an act of life, and operation is the only discoverer of life. We know not that anything lives but by the effects and works of life, and great and strong operations discover a powerful and vigorous life. Such are the operations of this law of sin, which are all demonstrations of its power. That which we have declared concerning its nature is that it consists in enmity. Now there are two general heads of the working or operation of enmity. First, aversion. Secondly, opposition. First, our Savior, describing the enmity that was between himself and the teachers of the Jews by the effects of it, saith in the prophet, "My soul loathed them, and their soul also abhorred me." Zechariah 11:8. Where there is mutual enmity, there is mutual aversion, loathing, and abomination. So it was between the Jews and the Samaritans. They were enemies and abhorred one another, as John 4:9. Second, opposition, or contending against one another, is the next product of enmity. Isaiah 63:10, he was turned to be their enemy, and he fought against them, speaking of God towards the people. Where there is enmity, there will be fighting. It is the proper and natural product of it. Now both these effects are found in this law of sin. First, for aversion. There is an aversion in it unto God and everything of God, as we have in part discovered in handling the enmity itself, and so shall not need much to insist upon it again. All indisposition to duty, wherein communion with God is to be obtained, all weariness of duty, all carnality or formality unto duty, it all springs from this root. The wise man cautions us against this evil, Ecclesiastes 5:1. Keep thy foot when thou goest to the house of God. Hath thou any spiritual duty to perform, and doth thou design the attaining of any communion with God? Look to thyself, take care of thy affections. They will be gadding and wandering, and that from their aversion to what thou is in hand. There is not any good that we would do wherein we may not find this aversion exercising itself. When I would do good, evil is present with me. At any time, at all times, when I would do anything that is spiritually good, it is present, that is, to hinder me, to obstruct me in my duty, because it abhors and loathes the thing which I have in hand. It will keep me off from it, if it be possible. In them in whom it prevails, it comes at length unto that frame which is expressed, Ezekiel 33:31. It will allow an outward bodily presence unto the worship of God, wherein it is not concerned, but it keeps the heart quite away. It may be some will pretend they find it not so in themselves, but they have freedom and liberty in and unto all the duties of obedience they attend unto. But I fear this pretended liberty will be found upon examination to arise from one or both of these causes. First, ignorance of the true state and condition of their souls, of their inward man and its actings towards God. They know not how it is with them, and therefore are not to be believed in what they report. They are in the dark, and neither know what they do nor whither they are going. It is like the Pharisee knew little of this matter, which made him boast of his duties to God himself, or, secondly, it may be, whatever duties of worship or obedience such persons perform, they may, through want of faith and an interest in Christ, have no communion with them, and if so, sin will make but little opposition unto them therein. We speak of them whose hearts are exercised with these things. And if under their complaints of them and groanings for deliverance from them, others cry out unto them, "Stand off, we are holier than ye." They are willing to bear their condition, as knowing that their way may be safe, though it be troublesome, and being willing to see their own dangers, that they may avoid the ruin which others fall into. Let us, then, a little consider this aversion, and such acts of obedience as wherein there is no concernment but that of God in the soul. In public duties there may be a mixture of other considerations. They may be so influenced by custom and necessity that a right judgment cannot from them be made of this matter. But let us take into consideration the duties of retirement, as private prayer and meditation and the like, or else extraordinary duties, or duties to be performed in an extraordinary manner. 1. In these will this aversion and loathing oft-times discover itself in the affections. A secret striving will be in them about close and cordial dealing with God, unless the hand of God and His Spirit be high and strong upon his soul. Even when conviction, sense of duty, dear and real esteem of God and communion with Him have carried the soul into its closet, yet if there be not the vigor and power of a spiritual life constantly at work, there will be a secret secret loathness in them unto duty, sometimes there will be a violent inclination to the contrary, so that the soul had rather do anything, embrace any diversion, though it wound itself thereby, than vigorously apply itself unto that which in the inward man it breathes after. It is worried before it begins and says, "When will the work be over?" Here God and the soul are immediately concerned, and it is a great conquest to do what we would, though we come exceedingly short of what we should do. Number two, it discovers itself in the mind also. When we address ourselves to God in Christ, we are, as Job speaks, to fill our mouths with arguments, chapter 23, 4, that we may be able to plead with Him as He calls upon us to do, Isaiah 43, 26. Put me in remembrance. Let us plead together. Whence the church is called upon to take unto itself words or arguments in going to God, Hosea 14, 2. The sum is that the mind should be furnished with the considerations that are prevailing with God, and be in readiness to plead them, and to manage them in the most spiritual manner to the best advantage. Now, is there no difficulty to get the mind into such a frame as to lay out itself to the utmost in this work? To be clear, steady, and constant in its duty, to draw out and make use of its stores and furniture of promises and experiences, it starts, wanders, flags, all from the secret aversion unto communion with God, which proceeds from the law of indwelling sin. Some complain that they can make no work of meditation, they cannot bend their minds to it. I confess there may be a great cause of this in their want of a right understanding of the duty itself and of the ways of managing the soul in it, which therefore I shall a little speak to afterward. But yet the secret enmity hath its hand in the loss they are at also, and that both in their minds and in their affections. Others are forced to live in family and public duties, they find such little benefit and success in private. And here hath been the beginning of the apostasy of many professors, and the source of many foolish, sensual opinions. Finding this aversion in their minds and affections from closeness and constancy in private spiritual duties, not knowing how to conquer and prevail against these difficulties through Him who enables us, they have at first been subdued to a neglect of them, first partial, then total, until, having lost all conscience of them, they have had a door opened unto all sin and licentiousness, and so to a full and utter apostasy. I am persuaded there are few that apostatize from a profession of any continuance, such as our days abound withal. But their door of entrance into the folly of backsliding was either some great and notorious sin that blooded their consciences, tainted their affections, and intercepted all delight of having anything more to do with God, or else it was a course of neglect in private duties, arising from a weariness of contending against that powerful aversion which they found in themselves unto them. And this also, through the craft of Satan, hath been improved into many foolish and sensual opinions of living unto God, without and above any duties of communion. And we find that after men have for a while choked and blinded their consciences with this pretense, cursed wickedness or sensuality hath been the end of their folly. And the reason of all this is that the giving way to the law of sin in the least is a giving strength unto it. To let it alone is to let it grow. Not to conquer it is to be conquered by it.
This Reformation audio track is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books. SWRB makes thousands of classic Reformation resources available, free and for sale, in audio, video, and printed formats. Our many free resources, as well as our complete mail order catalog, containing thousands of classic and contemporary Puritan and Reform books, tapes, and videos at great discounts, is on the web at www.swrb.com. We can also be reached by email at swrb@swrb.com, by phone at 780-450-3000, 3730, by fax at 780-468-1096, or by mail at 4710-37A Avenue, Edmonton, that's E-D-M-O-N-T-O-N, Alberta, abbreviated capital A, capital B, Canada, T6L3T5. You may also request a free printed catalog. And remember that John Calvin, in defending the Reformation's regulative principle of worship, or what is sometimes called the scriptural law of worship, commenting on the words of God, "which I commanded them not, neither came into my heart," from his commentary on Jeremiah 7:31, writes, "God here cuts off from men every occasion for making evasions, since he condemns by this one phrase, 'I have not commanded them,' whatever the Jews devised. There is then no other argument needed to condemn superstitions than that they are not commanded by God. For when men allow themselves to worship God according to their own fancies, and attend not to his commands, they pervert true religion. And if this principle was adopted by the papists, all those fictitious modes of worship in which they absurdly exercise themselves would fall to the ground. It is indeed a horrible thing for the papists to seek to discharge their duties towards God by performing their own superstitions. There is an immense number of them, as it is well known, and as it manifestly appears. Were they to admit this principle, that we cannot rightly worship God except by obeying his word, they would be delivered from their deep abyss of error. The prophet's words, then, are very important, when he says that God had commanded no such thing, and that it never came to his mind. As though he had said that men assume too much wisdom when they devise what he never required, nay, what he never knew."